This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. An engineer working under Russian occupation of Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant has told VOA that Russian forces have placed artillery and missile installations within and around the property of the plant and have caused explosions near the plant in an apparent attempt to discredit the Ukrainian army. Negotiations have been underway for inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency to gain access to the site to determine whether there is a risk of a catastrophic accident. The IAEA director said this week he hopes to conclude negotiations with the two countries on details of an inspection visit soon. The death toll from a train station attack in Ukraine has risen to 25. We'll get more on this story from the AP's Mike Gracia.
The death toll from Wednesday's Russian rocket attack on a train station in Ukraine is up to 25, including an 11-year-old boy found under the rubble of a house and a 6-year-old killed in a car fire near the station. The deputy head of the Ukrainian presidential office provided the updated casualty figures that includes 31 people injured. Prior to the attack, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had warned that Russian provocations and brutal strikes were possible as Ukraine marked both its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991 and 6 months since the Russian invasion. In his nightly address Wednesday, Zelensky said the Russian occupiers will bear responsibility for everything they have done. Elsewhere in the eastern region of Donetsk Wednesday, 3 people were killed and 1 more was wounded. I'm Mike Gracia.
And for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also, on the VOA mobile app via remote, this is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered the Russian military to increase the size of the country's armed forces by 137,000 amid Moscow's military action in Ukraine. AP correspondent Zarya Shakli has more on the story.
Putin's decree signed didn't explain whether the military will beef up its ranks by drafting a bigger number of conscripts, increasing the number of volunteer soldiers, or using a combination of both. The Kremlin has said that only volunteer contract soldiers take part in what it calls the special military operation in Ukraine, rejecting claims that it's pondering a broad mobilization. I'm Zarya Shakli.
At least 3 Iranian-affiliated militants were killed in multiple U.S. strikes in northeast Syria over the past 24 hours, according to the Pentagon. The Pentagon Press Secretary, Air Force General Pat Ryder, told reporters Thursday the first U.S. strike was in response to Wednesday's rocket attacks against 2 U.S. mission support sites, in which 3 U.S. service members suffered minor injuries. The U.S. strike killed 2 to 3 militants, according to an initial assessment. On Tuesday, the U.S. carried out airstrikes in eastern Syria that it said targeted an ammunition depot and other facilities used by groups linked to the Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Iran denied Wednesday any links to the sites. Iranian forces have been in Syria supporting President Bashar al-Assad's forces during Syria's civil war. The United States has about 900 troops in Syria, working with Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces to combat the Islamic State group. A federal judge directed the U.S. Justice Department late Thursday to unseal its redacted version of an affidavit it used to obtain a search warrant for former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. The Justice Department had opposed the affidavit being released in its entirety because it might compromise their investigation. During the search, FBI agents remove 11 sets of classified documents labeled confidential, secret, or top secret, according to a property receipt given to Trump's lawyers. The judge gave the Justice Department until noon Friday to submit a version of the affidavit containing the redactions it proposed earlier on Thursday. Just how much of the document will be unsealed and what details about the investigation it will reveal remains to be seen. For more news, as always, please join us at our website, voanews.com. Also, on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Today is Friday, August 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinirofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Presidents Biden and Zelensky discuss growing fears at Europe's largest nuclear plant as Russia moves to replenish its depleted forces in Ukraine.
The two leaders discuss the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, which temporarily lost connection to the electrical grid due to a nearby fire.
Taiwan proposes a record $19 billion in defense spending for next year amid threats from China.
The cabinet has pledged over $19 billion, a 13.9% boost on 2022. The budget includes funds for new fighter jets and anti-ship missiles, as well as special funds for the defense ministry.
And the World Food Programme in Ethiopia condemns Tigrayan forces for allegedly stealing more than 500,000 liters of fuel. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian President Vladimir Putin appears to be moving to replenish the depleted ranks of the Russian military by ordering a 13% increase in the country's troop strength by January 1st. Russian forces have suffered heavy losses in 6 months of bloody warfare in Ukraine. This has the troubled situation at Europe's largest nuclear power plant, occupied by Russian forces, was discussed in a phone call Thursday between U.S. President Joe Biden and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. The details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
In the call from the U.S. president to congratulate the Ukrainian leader a day after Ukraine marked its Independence Day, which Biden termed a bittersweet anniversary, the two leaders discussed the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, which temporarily lost connection to the electrical grid due to a nearby fire. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Russia should agree to demilitarize the zone around the plant and agree to allow an International Atomic Energy Agency visit as soon as possible to check on the safety and security of the systems.
Russia took control of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant early in the six-month-old war. Concerns about fighting around the facility have recently escalated, with the IAEA warning of a very real risk of a nuclear disaster. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Turkey is deepening trade relations with Russia in the face of Western sanctions against Moscow. Political observers say Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan could be relying on Russia's export to support ease Turkey's growing economic woes as he faces re-election next year. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Aiding Russia's construction of a nuclear power station in Turkey was the reason cited by Moscow for the recent transfer of $5 billion to Turkey, with reports that $10 billion more are coming in the next few weeks. The infusion of hard currency is a welcome boost for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose 2023 campaign for re-election is dogged by a plunging lira and inflation at nearly 80%. To safeguard his close ties with Vladimir Putin, Erdogan has refused to enforce Western sanctions against Russia. Earlier this month, at the Black Sea resort of Sochi, the two leaders held talks on further developing trade ties. Turkey has doubled Russian oil imports since this year's assault on Ukraine. Russian oligarchs continue to moor their super yachts in Turkish marinas, knowing that Turkish authorities won't attempt to seize them. Analysts say Erdogan has become a valuable Putin ally. Turkey and the United Nations have brokered a deal to export Ukrainian grain to world markets, and its export operations are based in Istanbul. Erdogan claims credit for the deal, saying it was only possible because of his close ties with Putin. But analysts warn that Putin may seek to leverage Erdogan's relationship and growing dependency on Russia to circumvent Western technology sanctions, putting Ankara on a collision course with its allies. With Turkey's economy in a weak state, sanctions analysts warn would trigger a devastating financial crisis. At the same time, analysts say Erdogan is placing his bets on Russia in the hope that Russian trade and support will revitalize his nation's economy ahead of next year's elections. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Taiwan has proposed a record-high $19 billion in defense spending for next year, a double-digit increase on 2022. Fiona Jones of Reuters reports.
Taiwan has proposed a record increase in defence spending for next year, weeks after China staged its largest ever military exercises around the island, which it views as its territory. The cabinet has pledged over $19 billion, a 13.9% boost on 2022. The budget includes funds for new fighter jets and anti-ship missiles, as well as special funds for the defence ministry. China carried out these war games after US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. Beijing viewed the trip as Washington attempting to interfere in its internal affairs. Taiwan's budget proposals, which must be approved by Parliament, mark the sixth consecutive year that the island has grown its defence spending. The Defence Ministry said in a statement the budget gave full consideration to the, quote, enemy threat, and was equivalent to 2.4% of Taiwan's projected GDP. China has been continuing its military activities near Taiwan, though on a reduced scale.
That's Fiona Jones of Reuters. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet has cast doubt on whether she will release the long-awaited report on the mass incarceration of Uyghurs in China's Xinjiang region before she leaves office on August 31st. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
When she announced her departure in June, Bachelet said she would publish the report before her term ended. In her final briefing as High Commissioner, she said she hoped it would be possible, but indicated its release, once again, might be delayed. Bachelet said her office has received substantial input from the Chinese government that must be carefully reviewed before the report can be issued. She said that was normal procedure for all country reports published by her office.
In my meeting with high-level national officials and regional authorities in Xinjiang, I raised concern about human rights violations, including reports of arbitrary detention and ill-treatment in institutions. And the report looks in-depth onto these and other serious human rights violations concerning the Uyghurs and other predominantly Muslim minorities in Xinjiang.
Human rights activists accuse China of mass detention, torture, and cultural persecution of 1 million Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims in so-called vocational camps. China denies the allegations, saying people in training centers receive skills they need to get good jobs. Bachelet said she raised many concerns with Chinese authorities during her visit to Xinjiang in May. In July, the Reuters news agency reported that China had sent Bachelet a letter asking her not to publish the report. She has confirmed receipt of that letter, which was signed by diplomats of some 40 countries. The High Commissioner said such solicitation from countries under the human rights spotlight are not unusual, adding she does not give in to pressure.
I've been receiving pressures from countries who want to publish and not to publish. You cannot imagine the numbers of letters, meetings, asking for the publication. Huge numbers. I mean, I have been under tremendous pressure to publish or not to publish, but I will not publish or withhold publication due to any such pressure. I can assure you of that.
Work on the report has been ongoing for the past 3 years. The High Commissioner has 1 week left on her mandate. She assured journalists that she was trying very hard to do what she had promised, namely to release the report before she leaves on August 31st. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Sweden's immigration policies are a big factor heading into elections next month of September 11th, when Swedes head to the polls to pick a new parliament, perhaps resulting in a new prime minister. The hard-right Sweden Democrats Party admits to having a neo-Nazi past and polls just ahead of the election show the party gaining political ground. Some observers say public concerns about Sweden's immigration policies could mean a previously unthinkable coalition between the far-right and moderate forces is on the verge of forming. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports from Malmö, Sweden.
Erik Hejarin is a political editor at Stockholm's Svenska Dagbladet newspaper. He tells VOA that a new political landscape is taking shape in Sweden ahead of the upcoming election, and it's unclear which coalition will take power. The Sweden Democrats, a populist party with ties to right-wing extremism in the 1990s, gained parliamentary seats in the 2010 election. It appears to be growing further in popularity, according to polls, and could result in an unlikely coalition.
A number of parties in Sweden still says that it's utterly unthinkable to cooperate or to form an alliance with the Sweden Democrats because of their past. And another way of looking at it is we've made some polls where we've asked which party could you accept as part of the government. Interestingly enough, Sweden Democrat, more people can accept them as part of the government than the Green Party.
Hajarin says the Liberals, moderates and other centrists to the right are likely to join forces with the Sweden Democrats party.
So we have two new coalitions that are the main alternative in this election, which makes it different in many ways. One of the interesting things now is that those coalitions join a wide range of parties. On the left, you have the left, far left, the centrists. And on the other side, you have the Liberal Party and the Sweden Democrats. Two kind of disparate coalitions, which has in themselves a lot of tension. It's not really clear how a government would function that emanates from such a wide coalition.
Part of the Sweden Democrats' appeal, observers say, plays on people's fears about migration. Sweden took in the largest number of refugees per capita in the 2015 wave that hit Europe. Unlike the United States, there are no background checks on arrivals. However, other Swedes find the Sweden Democrats' campaign ad abhorrent. Posting a picture of a train car with the party logo, spokesman Tobias Andersson tweeted, "Welcome to the repatriation train. You have a one-way ticket. Next stop, Kabul." Observers say Afghans are unfairly targeted, especially given the Taliban takeover last year, where ethnic and religious minorities could face death if returned. Swedish economist and blogger Julia Wicklander of Girls Globe and others warn that giving wider political berth to the Sweden Democrats undermines cherished values fundamental in Swedish society, like providing safety to people escaping conflict.
Sweden has this reputation of being a leader for human rights globally, a leader in terms of our global responsibility, our engagement with issues around the world. But a lot of things in the past decade have either stood still in Sweden or really stagnated. A lot of issues are also at risk. At the same time, a lot of people still look up to Sweden. When we don't reflect on history and we don't reflect on where Sweden is actually failing to stand up for human rights, we risk losing them.
The whole political debate has shifted from human rights and environment issues, now with a strong polarization on each side of the political spectrum, gaining ground in communities and families, Wicklander says, adding that in her view, the rhetoric is growing very charged and worrying. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Malmo, Sweden.
In other news, a conference of Japanese aid to Africa has started in Tunisia. The 8th Tokyo International Conference on African Development will include about 5,000 participants, including 30 heads of state and government. The talks will focus on accelerating Japanese investment and support for the continent's economy, society, and peace and stability. The French news agency AFP says Japan is set to provide $130 million in food aid and will provide assistance for food production, in particular rice, to offset high prices caused by the war in Ukraine. The wire service says the Tunisian Japanese Chamber of Commerce cites more than 80 projects and over 36 potential jobs that are on the table, including in the sectors of health, automobiles, and renewable energy. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Ethiopia's government has joined the World Food Program in condemning Tigrayan forces for allegedly stealing more than 500,000 liters of fuel meant for delivering food aid. Henry Wilkins reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
David Beasley, head of the UN's World Food Program, said Thursday on Twitter that Tigrayan forces stole 570,000 litres designated for humanitarian aid distribution in Ethiopia's embattled region of Tigray. The government demanded in a statement that the fuel be returned and the international humanitarian community take action against the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. The government has been fighting the TPLF for nearly 2 years. The news comes after a five-month-old ceasefire came to an end Wednesday, with the government and TPLF blaming each other for a new offensive in the north of the country. Tigray has been under a humanitarian blockade for around 8 months. Humanitarian organisations say parts of the region are likely in a state of famine due to a lack of aid, the distribution of which is exacerbated by fuel shortages. Kajetil Tronvol, a professor at Oslo New University College and an expert on the Ethiopian conflict, said on Twitter that a UN situation report stated the fuel had been loaned from Tigray authorities and claimed, therefore, that the TPLF was within its rights to take the fuel. A TPLF spokesperson could not immediately be reached for comment. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you, Henry. Health ministers attending the World Health Organization's 72nd Regional Committee for Africa in Lomé, Togo, has approved an 8-year strategy aimed at curbing diseases and responding quickly to health emergencies. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 400 people participated from 47 countries, including about 30 health ministers who attended the top annual health gathering in person while others joined online. After a week of discussions about some of Africa's most pressing health issues, countries adopted a new strategy for creating more resilient public health systems for responding to infectious and chronic diseases such as diabetes. The World Health Organization says early diagnosis and care could save the lives of many of the millions who die from the diseases. The plan also commits countries to reach critical targets by 2030 to strengthen their ability to prepare, detect, and respond to health emergencies. The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says the ministers also have launched a new campaign to curb sickle cell disease. She notes it is one of the most common yet least recognized illnesses in the region. However, like childhood tuberculosis, she says it has been pushed to the sidelines for far too long.
As we've seen with COVID-19, the impact of sickle cell disease extends well beyond health, posing significant economic and social costs for patients and their families. We can't afford to continue ignoring the threat. So greater investments and stronger collaboration and partnerships need to be prioritized. Childhood TB also doesn't typically receive much attention, even though one in every three TB cases among children globally occurs in our region.
She says both require timely diagnosis and treatment, as do other diseases such as monkeypox that go largely ignored until they make headlines elsewhere. Currently, she says 406 cases and 7 deaths have been confirmed across 11 African countries. While these are far fewer cases compared to other geographic regions, she says there is a need to increase the response. She notes there is a shortage of monkeypox vaccine, and whatever is available is being used in wealthier countries where the epidemic is raging. She says no monkeypox vaccines or antivirals are available in African countries.
We are making a plea that the situation that African countries have experienced with COVID-19 vaccines should not be repeated. And we are still hopeful that with the advocacy being carried out and the discussions with countries that are helping to produce the vaccines, that we may obtain vaccine supplies for African countries. This is not the case up to today.
Moeti says there is better news regarding COVID-19 coverage. She notes vaccination rates are going up among health workers, older people, and those at risk of severe illness, hospitalization, and death. While there is still much to be done, Moeti says she believes it is possible for African countries to catch up with the rest of the world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
New data from the European Space Agency's star mapping Gaia mission is providing researchers with a glimpse into the sun's past and future. ESA scientists have determined that our sun is currently middle-aged and is about 4.57 billion years old. The researchers found that our home star continues to fuse hydrogen into helium and is quite stable. As the sun continues to age, its surface temperature will increase from its current 5,700 degrees Celsius and will reach its highest temperature in 3.43 billion years, when it will be around 8 billion years old. The sun will then cool, increase in size, and become a red giant star when it's about 10 to 11 billion years old. After its red giant phase, the sun will reach the end of its life, will become a dim white dwarf, and billions of years later, cool down to be a lifeless black dwarf. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. In the run-up to the U.S. midterm elections, a view from Western Pennsylvania. I speak to a leading Democrat and Republican to gauge the political temperature in this key battleground state where analysts say the balance of power in the Senate could be decided. Trump-backed celebrity doctor Republican Mehmet Oz faces Democrat John Fetterman. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and my colleague Rick Pantaleo for a special edition of PCUSA with guest UNICEF's Regional Child Protection Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa, Andy Brooks. He'll tell us why child marriage and FGM are on the rise in the Horn of Africa and what's being done to protect young girls. Join us for Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington. Have a wonderful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than five decades ago, at the height of the Cold War, representatives of 18 nations drafted the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT. In the years that followed, nearly every country in the world joined the NPT. The NPT has made the world safer as nuclear weapons states took steps to reduce their stockpiles. However, the treaty is under increasing strain, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a speech to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference. He noted that the DPRK continues to expand its unlawful nuclear program and continues its ongoing provocations against the region. Iran also remains on a path of nuclear escalation. Although it publicly claims to favor a return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, since March, Iran has been unwilling to accept such a deal. Secretary Blinken affirmed that getting back to the JCPOA remains the best outcome for the United States, for Iran, for the world. Russia's ongoing war of aggression against Ukraine is a brazen violation of international law, but its actions also violate the assurances that it provided to Ukraine in the 1994 Budapest Memorandum. Under the terms of the memorandum, which welcomed Ukraine's accession to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and its commitment to remove all nuclear weapons from its territory, Russia committed to respect Ukraine's independence and territorial integrity. This sends the worst possible message to countries around the world that may think they need to have nuclear weapons to protect their sovereignty. There is no place in our world for nuclear deterrence based on coercion, intimidation, or blackmail, declared Secretary Blinken.
Together with the United Kingdom and France, we've released a set of principles and best practices that should be expected of every responsible NPT nuclear weapon state, among them that every effort has to be made to ensure that nuclear weapons are not used again.
The United States is committed to avoiding costly arms races and facilitating arms control arrangements wherever they are possible. Indeed, President Biden negotiated to extend the New START treaty with Russia until 2026. President Biden also reiterated his readiness to negotiate a framework to replace New START. The fundamental role of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter nuclear attacks on the United States, its allies, and partners. The United States would only consider the use of such weapons in extreme circumstances to defend its vital interests.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.